This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
I have travelled out of London today to the depths of the Devonshire countryside. At the end of a mile-long track, I am confronted by a series of converted farm buildings. They nestle quietly in a beautiful valley. This is the country home of one of Britain's most celebrated product designers. His work has touched the very fabric of everyday life. Think of the Kenwood Chef, the Kodak Instamatic camera, the parking meter, the Intercity 125 train, the London taxicab, Parker pens, or a range of Wilkinson razors. All have been designed by my guest today. Kenneth Grange is now in his late 70s, but shows no sign of slowing up and spends much of his time in his studio workshop musing on ever more inventive ways to make products meaningful and beautiful. As I entered the main house, I am confronted by a life-size, Gormley-esque, hollowed-out wooden figure. At the moment, it is filled with books, but it has a far more practical and witty eventual use in a masterful bit of forward planning by Grange. More of which later in this fascinating and entertaining interview.
Well, we're sitting in your farmhouse in the middle of Devon at the end of a very, very long, windy track, and it's an idyllic situation. And so, you know, you're now well into your seventh decade. I think you've almost caught up, but not quite, with Bruce Forsyth, who was celebrated.
very close, I tell you.
So, I mean, you can look back, you know, sitting here in this lovely spot, on, you know, a fantastic life of being involved with what I'm sure you love, you know, the designing of products and what makes them tick and how they feel and look and give people pleasure. So I'd like to just wind back to the beginning and just get a quick kind of resume of how you entered in this world. I know that you went to Willesden School of Art and then following that, I think, did you go straight into National Service?
No, that was there's a key few months there which really I think are very influential. We another young fellow and I, left art school when we were probably about 17 and a half, for the sake of this conversation, that's enough accuracy. And because a chap had turned up at the college who had been a student, and he'd remembered the headmaster, and he was working for BBC Television, and he came to find two young graduates who could start a life in television. His particular responsibility, and he was based at Alexandra Palace, was to look after the what they called the scenic art department. Then an architect had the job of designing the set for the television production, whatever it was, be it a news or be it some drama or something. And this architect, he was always an architect, used to sign his drawings, so-and-so, you know, ARIBA, etc. And out of that would then come the need for somebody to actually paint the background and occasionally construct something, but most of it was painted. So it was actually in the very ancient tradition of the theatre.
Scenic painting.
The painting of scenes.
Yeah.
And he had, this man who came to the college, had this little department, perhaps half a dozen people, you know, most of them not mature necessarily, but much older than we, this young fellow and I, and off we went. And it was a magical time, and I loved it. And we used to paint on the floor, which was apparently an English tradition as opposed to the French tradition of the theatre, where canvases was sort of pinned to the floorboards, in this case, the floor of the old Alexandra Palace Theatre. And you used to walk all over them. you'd have walk-in sort of slippers with sort of canvas tied to them, and paint with long-handled brushes.
Yes.
And this was the English tradition of scene painting.
Oh, right. Okay.
So that's a funny thing to have learned.
The specially constructed scenic sheds.
Slot in the floor.
A slot in the floor.
Exactly. This was the English tradition.
Oh, I see.
And
I didn't
oddly
know
enough, it might also tell you something about the English tradition in all sorts of enterprises.
Yes.
You know, cheap and cheerful, rather than do it properly.
But so just prior to that, just let's touch on very quickly your family background, and it's any if there are any sort of residues of creativity there.
Try to be quick about that, but it is a clue. My father was a policeman, but came from an enterprising and talented family of musicians. Five brothers, all musicians, pro, semi-pro. So there was a musical tradition, mm-hmm. and I think my father, who was in the police, in a band in the police, and played the banjo, mm-hmm. and so on. But anyway, he also was a very accomplished draftsman. And behind you, that painting on the against the wall of those flowers, that's one of his paintings, which in skill terms is actually quite a high level for an amateur.
Yeah.
I really believe that now. Yeah. So he'd got that component in him. Mm-hmm. So there's this artistic bit of the man, but he'd grown up as a policeman and was in every way a very conservative, straightforward, God-fearing, law-abiding man.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I put my hand up in school to apply for a scholarship to go to art college, which was not my nature to put my hand up anyway. I was a very sort of timid boy.
Yeah.
But I put my hand up, and when I got home and I said to my mum, you know, I've done this, and she said, oh, wonderful, Bill. She always called me Bill, never ever called me Ken or Kenneth in my whole life, my mother. Anyway, it's another story. And when he came home, he was furious. Because his experience as a policeman of artists was actually that, by and large, they were layabouts. In those years, strangely enough, he still couldn't or chose not to correlate the artists he knew in Bayswater Road with the artists that he so admired. He used to take his days off and go to the museums and go to the galleries and sit there and get permission to make copies of old masters. So he grew up in this strange schizophrenia with regard to the arts.
Right,
so he wasn't keen on the art school business.
Right, okay.
She was, however.
Right.
And so I went to art
school. And you were aware of his feelings about...
Well, yes, he was straightforward. He said, you know, it's a good idea, you know.
Yeah.
What you want to do is be a lawyer or be an engineer. Engineer, he thought I'd be. But as I prospered and he realised, which was the other side of my education, that I in each case I managed to get employment with very decent people of sort of, you know, good moral character, good mostly socialists, which was not his instinct. But he realised that I was in a sense in the hands of people he would have respected and admired.
Yeah.
And when I got to work for architects, which is most of my employers,
they
were all much better educated than my father or our family. But people he would certainly respect, and therefore he felt me reassured as my life unfolded, first in college and then in work.
Okay, so you're
so it's a funny mixture. Sorry,
I understand. Rambling. So you're now painting scenery on the floor, and so you're 17 and a half, going on 18.
Okay, we got to that bit.
And so the reason I'm interested is because, you know, a large proportion of royal designers, because of the nature of their age, all experienced national service, which had, one way or another, a real effect on their lives.
Yes.
I think you went into national service, which would have been 18, would it have been?
Yes, a little
18?
Bit later. Can I quickly
I'll
try and gallop over those bits. So went to BBC Television, didn't stay there because there'd been some blunder about who they could employ and who they couldn't, and so we were dismissed, actually. But and enjoyed it. I tried to get into the film industry, didn't succeed. And my headmaster again came to the rescue and got me an appointment with an old colleague of his who was in the Town Planning Institute in Bedford Square. I remember it to this day. And there was I, chap with a portfolio of life drawings, experience at painting scenes at BBC Television, sitting in the office of a town planner. But she introduced me to an architect, so I got a job in an architectural office for about 6 months before I went into the army. Okay. So left school at sort of 17 and a half, say, 3 or 4 months at BBC Television, 6 months. So I joined the army when I was nearer 19 than 18.
Okay.
And I went into the army, and it worked out extraordinarily well for me. Of course, I hated it in the beginning, as one does. It was really rigorous and all that stuff. But I, because of this architectural experience, I'd worked for a firm called Archon, who I later realised are extremely sort of modernist architects, like the Fosters of the day. And they had given me a very nice recommendation. And I showed this to this interviewing officer when I was sort of a quarter of my way through my army career. And he said, well, you know, there's no point in you sort of aiming to be anything in the army. He said, I'll make you an architectural draftsman. Because, right. And that was the beginning of a marvellous life.
Yes.
I went from one little camp to another, wound up in a publications unit where they taught me to do technical drawing. And I also, I think, uncovered my instinctive interest for construction and taking things apart and reassembling them. So I had a job for about 6 months drawing mechanisms for instructors' manuals.
Right.
So I learned a bit about a bit about publication.
Yes.
I learned a bit about printing.
Yes.
I certainly learned about technical drawing.
Yeah.
I also, I think, started to cultivate an interest in mechanics.
Ah.
So the army did me a great service.
Yes.
The other thing the army did, Mike, was actually turn me from a 9-stone weakling to a 12-stone athlete. and that's a truth. And I also think that's been amazingly beneficial in my life.
Yeah.
You know, I could always work 2 or 3 nights on the trot.
Yeah.
Without sleep.
Yeah.
And I think it owes a lot to a physical change that the army gave me.
So it's the kind of discipline that was instilled.
Discipline and
in you.
Physique. Just sheer physique. You know, it's rigorous and so on, but they gradually build you from being a very ordinary structure of an animal into a much fitter animal with much bigger scope of abilities.
Yeah. So then, after you were demobbed from your national service years, you, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you worked for Jack Howe.
I worked He was the last of 3 architectural offices I worked for when I came out of the army.
Yeah.
The first one was a Polish, marvellous Polish man called Bronek Katz, who was in partnership with a man called Vaughan, so it was Katz and Vaughan. They were starting to work on the Festival of Britain.
Yeah.
The second man I worked for was Gordon Bowyer, also working on the festival. And the third one was Jack Howe, who by then the festival had opened, and I had a lot to do with the festival, very much working my way through that. But he had, like, the classic architect stroke industrial designer's office, where he did some buildings. But he also, because it was his nature as well, he's very much a rigorous constructor, was Jack, and he'd started to get jobs which you would call industrial design, which were like street lighting comms, which were bus shelters. And isn't that strange? After 30-odd, 40 years, I then had quite a reputation as a bus shelter designer, starting then with Jack. So all that, I think, was fantastic background.
And you were, I think, also taking on a little freelance project.
Yes,
very much
his encouragement.
And so forth.
Yes,
and
which is again, you see, cut across you.
Maybe. Yeah.
But I think it's again one of the finer aspects of an architectural environment. I think those small offices, they were very much, I think they were quite responsible towards their employees. And his attitude and the others had always been, you know, if you can get a job, do it.
Yeah.
You know, so you were encouraged to pick up jobs, and I did drawings, perspectives, and murals, and, you know, bits and pieces. And I was offered a job a freelance job to do an exhibition stand for a little tiny organisation called the Atomic Energy Authority. Mm. And I did it, and it was successful. 6 months later, they called and asked me if I'd like to do another one. And, of course, I said yes, went along in my lunchtime on the underground and the bus, got the job, and on the way back, terrified to realise what I'd said yes to, which was a huge amount of work, and way beyond my evenings and weekends. And when I got back to the office, I said to Jack, Jack, I've got a marvellous job, but I can't handle it. No, I'd like to give it to you, bring it into the office, and of course I'll do it, and so on. Because what one was, I think, what I was interested in those days was not anything to do with money. I mean, it wasn't, you didn't take on any of this work because you were getting money for it, but because it was the privilege to be asked to do something. Mm. See, it's hard to think today how rare work was that was, you know, that could be your own. Mm. And anyway, so I said to him, that's it. And I thought he'd be delighted because it would mean quite a big job in the office. And he said, no, I don't think it's a good idea. He said, I think you'd better leave and do it, which terrified me. But within 3 months, I was employing 4 people, and it was the biggest job ever.
So was this the beginning of Ken Grange Design? Was this 1958 when you started?
Yes. So that was 19... I think I left him in 50... I left him in 54 or 55.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of Kenneth Grange Design.
Ah, right, okay.
An exhibition designer.
As an exhibition. So your early years of Kenneth Grange Design were spent mostly designing exhibitions.
And exhibitions and interiors and so on.
So how did the product start to creep in?
Well, in two ways. Again, a reflection upon Jack and upon that society, their generosity towards youngsters. He had, when I left him, he'd had quite a lot to do with the then Council of Industrial Design.
Yeah.
And he'd put my name forward to them as a young designer who they might add to their list of people that they might recommend. That's one strand.
Yeah.
And the other is that I was doing a job for him. He'd got a job to do a pavilion for Kodak at one of the world fairs. He asked me to do the interior, and I was doing it, and it was happy as Larry. It was way ahead of time, and there I was, just like window display in this pavilion of cameras. Mm. For Kodak was the client. And I said, just larking about, because I was so high-spirited and felt very relaxed, and I said, you know, this would be a marvellous job if only the cameras weren't so bloody ugly.
Yes.
And a man over there who got his, you know, he was, I don't know what he was doing, shuffling papers and messing about and so on, obviously a management-type workman. And he said, oh, really? He said, what would a designer charge to do a camera, for example? And I said, I've no idea, and maybe £200 or £300, something like that. And he said, oh, left it at that. We parted, and I went back to London that night. Following morning, the telephone rang, and there's Grange on his own in his bedroom come studio, no employees, and the telephone rang, and a man said, my name's Dr. Pitt, I'm Director of Development at Kodak, and I understand you're going to design a camera for us. The man who I'd casually talked to in Brussels was the marketing director.
How fortuitous is that?
Isn't that extraordinary tale?
Yeah.
So
so that was the beginning of your...
It wasn't actually quite the first job, because that recommendation from Jack had earlier got me to do a redesign of the parking meter. So the parking meter was the very first thing in production.
Yes.
But then the camera followed soon after that, and then I was up and away. Ken Wooden.
I mean, I'll just go through some of the list, because, you know, these things were very much everyday items, part of everyone's life. So, you know, we talked about the parking meter. You've got the very famous Kenwood food mixer range. You've got the Wilkinson razors. You've got the Kodak, which you've mentioned, Imperial typewriters, Morphy Richards, irons, Ronson lighters, Bendix washing machines, angle poise, Parker pens, a British Rail high-speed train, which I want to talk about later, the TX1 cab and
black cab,
BMW speakers, which again I'll talk about later because that's a more recent job. So you really kind of obviously had the bit between your teeth and enthusiasm and just the love of being, you know, for me, you touched on something just now that I believe in, which is, you know, if you go into this business of design in its broader sense, to make money, in my view, you should never be there.
Because
me, it's always been passion. It's always been a love of, you know, being in a very privileged position.
I think it's a mixture of things. And of course, it depends on your nature and on your background and on the support systems around you. But there's only a few components that are important. I think one is the privilege of being entrusted to do something. And if someone asked you to put up a new gate, I think there's also a degree of privilege in that. I mean, they're trusting you to do something very specific, only you. Yeah. I think that's quite a big part of it for me.
Yeah.
I think the other is that somewhere in your makeup, somewhere in your learning, in your experience, you've started to cultivate opinions about design, style, ambience, the aesthetic, and so on. I think that's another bit of it. And I think they're really everything. And I think to be trusted is a wonderful fillip and a real beginning of an obligation you have. Mm. I think once somebody walks through the door and says, "I'd like you to do so and so," then you can't back out of it. I think you're stuck with that obligation till the last moment.
And do you think that in those relationships that you have, that often the key element for a fantastic job is a real sympathy and understanding with the client who has come to you because they in turn have an understanding or belief in design and that they want you to make it that much, as opposed to being, you know, often these middle management people who are just doing a job and they don't have that particular quality to understand what designers can do. Mm. I mean, how important is the client for a really successful outcome?
Well, and I'm tempted to think that every generation thinks it had the best.
Yeah, of course.
It's a nice story that I think tells us a lot. About 1970s, 80s, whatever it was, I built some sort of reputation and things were rolling along nicely. Let's say at this time I'm in my office. Now the office is in Hampstead, which I'm renting. I'm employing 10 to 12 people. And by most terms in our trade, that's in the top half a dozen people in the game. And I knew an American designer, a New Yorker, who, talented man. I admired him very much. And our circumstances were remarkably similar. He employed the same sort of number. He had a similar income. And we did similar things. Domestic appliances, relatively small products. And he was coming through London. And he came to see us, and we were good friends. And in the course of the conversation, he said, "Tell me, of the things you design, how many go into production?" And I'd had reason to think on that in that time. And I could say to him, in all truth, maybe 85-90% of the things I design actually get into the shops. And he said, "My goodness, that's amazing." He said, "In my business," because I've also had reason to check it, hence my question, "my answer would be exactly the inverse. Maybe 15% of what I design go into production." And we talked about it, and that stuck in my mind, because in later years, in these years, the last decade, I can say that the young men who worked for me, who've now out there on their own, they're much closer to the American model than to my old model. Mm. And the reason is that the use of design has so grown, but it's grown as a business tool rather than as a sort of a passion or a necessity on the part of usually one man who was like the original client. All my clients were one man, sometimes even the owner of the company.
Yes.
But whether they were owner or managing directors, they were wholly responsible for that key point in the history of that firm, be it Kodak or Ronson or Kenwood. It was a person.
And they were willing to back their hunches.
Exactly.
And, of course, now, because that's been pushed down the line to middle management, who are often fearful and will commission various people to do various things which will fall down the
way. Absolutely. And none of them, and the designers too, none of them expecting that it would be sure to be a production thing. But doesn't stop these youngsters today being bloody talented and working their heart out to make it so.
Yeah.
But when they get home at night, you know, the 15% is closer to than to my 85%.
Yeah.
Because on the way through there is the third component of the success that you and I think have both enjoyed, which is the accident whereby you hit it off with somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a peculiar thing in life, isn't it?
Very
and
special.
It, you know, how it gets into your being or not, a rigmarole of reasons. But in these one-to-one situations, you've got to like one another.
Yeah.
And that's pretty damned important, which isn't anything like the same importance today.
No. No, I would agree with that totally. I mean, having those personal connections with people, you know, beyond just client and supplier kind of relationship, always makes for a better end product, I think.
Yes.
So you're successful, and suddenly you find yourself as one of the founding partners of Pentagram in 1972, and you were at that firm for, I mean, you left in 1999, but during that period that you were there, which is quite a long period, saw that firm at the height of its powers, I would say, and with partners of the calibre of Alan Fletcher, John McConnell, Theo Crosby, you were all kind of superstars in your own right. And I'm interested to know, you know, what it was like working with such a diverse bunch of talented people in that sort of hubbub of, I suppose the high point would have been the late 70s going into the 80s, when you were really, really buzzing, all of you were buzzing. What was it like working there at that time?
I think to talk about the 70s and 80s, to illustrate the dynamic of the times, the anecdote about how Pentagram started, I think, is relevant. I had recommended Crosby, Fletcher, Forbes to Kodak to do a corporate identity. And 12 months later, and we got to know one another, not intimately, but well, 12 months later, they had landed a client in the form of BP. And BP had developed out of packaging and so on into asking them to look at the prospects for self-service filling stations. And they were well set in terms of the architecture of such places and, of course, the marketing and packaging and presentation of goods side, but knew nothing about product. They asked me, there's an outside contractor, to work with them. And we did, and it developed, and it gradually slipped into partnership for a complex of, in a way, more personal reasons. But the fact that at that moment in time there wasn't a self-service filling station in the country tells you about the opportunities for the growth, the explosion of commerce,
of course,
of which we were at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So you'd got an explosion in advertising. The brightest and best of the London advertising scene grew.
Yeah.
And on its back, graphics.
Yeah.
And on its back, film, TV film, and so on.
Yeah.
So we were part and parcel. And the day we opened the office in 1972, we had London's best party.
Mm.
I mean, you know, it would have been the hello of the day.
Yeah.
And every journalist in London turned up, and everybody, you know, any TV presenters, any personalities of today, you might think of it, incredibly lucky to come to a party. They were all there.
Mm.
And that was because these were the times, and this was an example, this office opening up, of people who were already well established.
Yeah.
Suddenly, all that community could see that this was part and parcel of the growth of a new dynamic, which we would now call the growth and usage of design.
Yes. So no, I can quite see.
I think
that.
It's quite an interesting little anecdote.
It is, and in fact, it contrasts with what you were saying just now about, you know, the lack of success in getting products actually launched now. I mean, then, as you say, the market was pretty empty.
Absolutely.
And there was a real passion and need for these things. I mean, you know, the idea of not having a forecourt shop is kind of really unheard of. You know,
but I mean, such was the opportunity that when we made the presentation, I remember it clearly, made the presentation to BP, and it was a big number, they took some persuading that we needed a roof over the filling, over the pumps.
Yeah.
Because up to that time, the poor guy who filled your tank stood in the rain.
Yeah.
And they couldn't necessarily make the jump that assumed that the customers, who were not going to be given a discount, would want shelter.
And of course, and it was the self-service. It was the beginning of the self-service era, of course.
It was.
Because you would have an attendant.
Yeah.
It would be like the old Hopper painting of the lone
Absolutely.
Little petrol station.
There was only one self-service station in the country.
Yeah, good heavens.
Astonishing, isn't it?
It is astonishing. So what was your view, you know, once you got bedded into to Pentagram, working with a large multidisciplinary consultancy, what were the pros and cons of?
Well, we thought that, and we were influenced by writers and comments and the stories that were going around. We thought that if you could actually set up shop and say, we will give you everything you need by way of what we saw as the scope of design, which you could say generally was sort of publicity, generally was housing architectures, and generally the you know, the commercial products. This would be a pretty potent package.
Yeah.
In the event, we only in the history of Pentagram had one client who wanted all three. And he only wanted one, all three, because he came to us for one skill, which was, in his terms, graphic. And this was Alan Fletcher's dotted Reuters.
Yes.
Who then employed Theo to do buildings and then employed me to do products. So one client in all the history. But it tells you that still we came to be regarded as, in the design trade, as this omnibus affair, but actually to the commercial world as a place where you went for the best of a particular discipline.
Right.
So we operated exactly as we were before, and to this day, substantially the same.
That
Pentagram offers you a high skill in a particular little avenue of design you're interested in.
Yes, and I guess the mechanism of Pentagram itself, on a business level, is kind of sharing of what would be called, you know, the in-house facilities, you know, secretarial, accounting, and all that. And you were able to carry on with your little satellite companies, really, within that.
And were quite willful in encouraging the continuance of the individuals as stars. I mean, and that, I personally think, was one of the great successes of Pentagram.
Yes.
That we did not subsume our individual talents, our individual,
very evident
reputations.
I mean, I think you also had if I remember rightly at the time, you would, although I know it's changed in recent years, but there was no one was elevated from the ranks, as it were.
No.
They would always have to go off.
That's right. And I think in those years it was probably an intelligent ambition. I think as time's gone on, circumstances change, so I think there's a different set of arguments about it today. Yeah. But that's another story.
Yeah. Well, while you were there, I mean, I want to sort of move on to probably one of your most, I would think, prestigious, and I would have thought for you one of the most exciting projects that you were involved with, and that's the front end, the business end of the 125 train, and obviously the internal layout. But I mean, it was quite a very striking piece of work I remember at the time seeing it publicised. How did that come about? Because it was a very special job, and they're still trundling away around the country.
Yes, now, in fact, if you'd come down today by train, you'd have come on one. So I know it intimately, of course. Although it's a huge job in anybody's portfolio and very important to me, it still has a lot of the components of very, very, very much smaller clients within it, insofar that my very first work for British Rail, as it then was extremely modest. You know, I'd do a frame in which they put posters, mm-hmm. something as really modest as that.
Yeah.
And then you graduate from one thing to another and so on. But also, the hierarchy of British Rail was founded upon what you'd call modern design ambitions.
Yeah.
There's an organisation in the landscape, and very much my peers, people I admire hugely, which was called Design Research Unit.
Oh, yes.
And they were the, in many ways, the model on which Pentagram was founded. Mm. And they were looked to by any of the big institutions for this corporate design advice, you'd call it. So they did all of the essential componentry of the railways of the time.
Yeah.
They didn't do, because they're, for another set of reasons, the rolling stock hadn't come into the orbit of this design ambition. But they did graphics, they did signage, they did overhead gantries, they did platforms, they did even the stations and so on. So Design Research Unit and British Rail were a powerful and, you know, real serious force in the landscape. They also had influenced the aircraft industry. They'd influenced British Airways, as was then was called. So there was a background in the railways and in probably the aircraft, British European Airways, yes. And British, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
So both of those were great. They were familiar with design and had got what we now call design managers in place, who were naturally coming out of institutions like the Design Council.
Yeah.
And a man who was at the British, who was at Design Council, moved into the railways, a chap called George Williams, and he was active in finding young designers who would follow on this pattern that was established by Design Research Unit. So I remember him, my going to see him once, and there am I, very, very lowly in the order of things, and he said to me, if ever you want any work, just give me a call. I mean, what a sentence to have come from such a bloke, a man in such importance.
Yeah.
And it was followed on. So eventually I got to do the train as a result of doing a number of other small things. But even the train wasn't, we'd like you to design the train at all. It was asking me if I would just decorate the outside of a vehicle that they themselves were developing.
I see.
And I have a model. I'll show you later. I have a model of their first attempt at a train.
Uh-huh.
And I did the decoration, which was the commission I'd got, and then without asking them, and I'd got time, I started teasing out a design for the vehicle itself, using wind tunnel,
and
I had to have some basis on which I'd set about a train. I'd only done cameras, for Christ's sake, before.
Yeah,
so
yes.
I knew nothing about trains.
Well, it obviously worked very well, because...
It's a long tale, and we don't have time this morning, but there's a long succession of events that eventually got to be the vehicle that's out there now. And they were all to do with some of the things that I touched on earlier, where individual people were in positions of power.
Mm.
And I'll go on in a moment to another side of this that I still think is terribly influential in those years, which is the relationship of that person and the corporation. So you could have people like George Williams and like James Cousins, people in positions of, they were directors, of a particular bit of the railways, but they were very much respected for their intellectual talents within the corporation. And that in turn meant that they could bring in levels of skill and levels of passion that I think today they can't afford to, because today it's a sort of set of commercial strictures and patterns that make those judgments much more corporate and much more sort of, you know, business answerable than in those years, when it was to do with what you now I think you'd call sort of more sort of cultural ambitions for these institutions.
Yes. I mean, that is a great pity, that the kind of entrepreneurial sort of spirit of individuals, whether they were the you know, at the very top, i.e. the people that owned the companies, or people that have been put in place because they themselves have got a natural ability to understand, and they're given free rein to go to Ken Grange or whoever. And they're respected for it. You respect them because you know that they have an inherent understanding of what you do. And their superiors say, well, these people know what they're doing, let them get on with it.
That's right.
It doesn't happen so much
anymore. These would be the people who you know were going to be on juries that appointed... I mean, if there were a Turner Prize of those days, these are men you'd know would naturally be on the jury. So there was a sort of pattern of design aristocracy growing up.
During that period, that Pentagram, from 72 to 1999, what would you say were the most kind of personally fulfilling projects and products that you, looking back on them, that you would say, yes, that really for me is, I achieved my ambition on that?
Well, it's little known now, but Reuters were a wonderful client. Reuters were an exceptional client in anybody's old portfolio. And again, down to a person, but they employed Alan, they employed Theo, and they employed me. And the level of intelligence, the intellectual level inside Reuters was extraordinarily high. Sometimes quite unnerving. I remember going once to a meeting. And it wasn't to do, the directors weren't there, but they were sort of, you know, department heads, and we were talking about a particular bit of equipment I'd been working on. And I'd made the presentation, and the keyboard I'd coloured in a particular way I thought was appropriate to the usage. And one of these young journalist-turned-manager said, explain to me why you've chosen those colours. And I honestly, I didn't have a ready-made answer. I didn't have an intellectual reason. Yeah. I didn't have a sort of well-summarised thesis, which is what he expected, because excellent Oxford education, excellent circumstance in which he worked, excellent peers around him.
Yeah.
So there, everything was...
You had reason.
Had to be intelligently justified. Yeah. It wasn't some bloke saying, I like pink. You know, which is mostly where I'd come from, frankly.
But then, you know, with designers, I think actually there's a whole mechanism in place which we can call being intuitive. And I think that intuitive is a kind of throwaway thing, and that you just pluck it out of thin air. I personally don't think that. I think an intuitive understanding or approach to a job is actually steeped in years and years of real connection with things.
So do I.
And I think that all that happens is it comes out naturally. And you, when you're confronted by someone wanting you to justify why you're... I can remember myself doing some work with a Japanese company, and the Japanese want you to explain every single thing.
Yes.
And the moment you explain it, everyone's happy. But you could not get away with saying, right. Well, I like green.
No, that's right. But it also makes us, in personal terms, much more difficult people to live with. How do you feel when, and a few times I confess to fall back upon saying, you know, I'm the artist around here. Now, I never ever have called myself an artist, but it's an aesthetic determination,
yes,
that is only to do about art. It's not to do about justification or intelligence.
Well, I think that, you know, as designers, that's just a kind of a label. I think we are, you know, creative beings who are sensitive to all things.
Are you unhappy about if someone says, are you an artist?
Not really.
No, I'm not either.
Not at all, because I just think that, you know, the word designer or industrial designer just came out of a particular era, and before that we would have been artisans or craftsmen or whatever it is. But I see we're all.
But
connected.
Don't you think it also came out of the sort of correctness of the time, the sort of social political correctness of the time?
Yeah.
And when I went to art school, you see, there was fine art and there was commercial art.
And I was indeed would be termed a commercial artist.
Absolutely.
When I started in the very, very early 60s, I went into a commercial art studio.
That's right.
So we were called artists, but we were working for commerce.
It wasn't an accident that very intelligent people of the day, Misha Black, Milner Gray, Games, Pick, I mean, those guys, they coined the phrase industrial artists.
Yes.
So it was the society of industrial artists, which is very interesting.
Yes, it's true. We've got to the, I think we've got to the end of your period at Pentagram, which is 9 years ago you left in 1999. Why did you feel that was the moment to leave? What made you quit? What was obviously a long, had things changed dramatically? The industry changed? The company changed? Or
I don't think it was quite as pat as I'm going to say, but I was with, yesterday, Mervyn Kalansky was here.
Yes, he was one of the...
And I haven't seen Mervyn in 4 or 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't had a conversation with him for more like 10 or 15 years, a real private conversation. And it was a most enjoyable time. And we started talking about Alan leaving and about Mervyn leaving.
Did Alan leave after you?
No, he left before.
Just before?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, you left in 99.
Probably, I think, I'm not sure, but I think if I left in 99, and I thought it was later than that, but I'm not arguing, but I know the truth. I think he left in 96, that sort of time.
Okay. Yep.
So, and we now reflect that, in many ways, his best years started then. And Mervyn's best years, I think, started after he left.
Mm.
Alan had a wonderful history, and he was massively influential in Pentagram. So, let's say, for the first 10 or 15 years of Pentagram, Alan and Mervyn, great contributors, as was Theo, and perhaps as was I. We opened offices in America, and the whole organisation, without any diminution of its stature, changed from being such sort of individual single players to being in a degree more corporate. I don't mean for a moment that they're not stars in the States, but as a whole, it reflects the change in commerce too,
yes,
where the individuals who Alan went on after 96 to work for, and the individuals that I have subsequently worked for, and Mervyn, are a degree a reflection of what we were good at, which is a one-to-one.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think actually, you know, knowing Alan's work very well and having interviewed Alan and knew him certainly for the last 10 years of his life, I would agree with what you're saying. I think that the spirit of Pentagram, prior to Pentagram, when it was Fletcher, Ford and Gill, which is dynamic for any graphic designer.
Absolutely.
Looking at that,
yes,
work,
sure, sure,
and even
sure.
Now,
yeah,
a lot of that spirit seemed to re-enter Alan's life the moment he left. And I think that's all to do with putting your personal mark on the page. And, you know, Alan got to the point where not only his familiar handwriting became more evident, but, you know, physically cutting things out, physically doing away with type altogether, it became him.
Absolutely.
And I think he was, his work showed that kind of joy.
I do too.
This is coming from me, and it's nothing to do with, you know, all of the offices around the world and all the corporate clients that I probably didn't like working for because I was forced into.
If Alan had not died a couple of years ago, he would have eventually expired at some ripe old age, still being as good as he ever was.
I agree with that.
I think so.
I agree with that. I agree with that totally. I think he was inventive.
And hopefully I will too. So
I'm sure you will. Let me talk about you post Pentagram now, because you know, that's as I said, it's quite some time ago, and you spend your time. You know, I mean, I think one could say that because you are now in your, you know, your
dotage.
Well into your, well, okay, I wasn't going to say that, but okay, you mentioned the word dotage at a time when many people would be off playing golf or going on gentle cruises. You don't do that. I happen to know you travel a lot, you lecture, you are at the Royal College, and you still actively design. So just tell me about what you've been doing in that post-Pentagram period.
I think I've been lucky all my life, and I think you know, you get luck, and you cultivate, not luck, but you cultivate the consequences of that bit of luck, and that's to do with personality, etc., etc. And so it was a piece of luck that caused us to buy this place, and I bought this place 6 or 7 years before I left Pentagram. This, as a canvas, this place we're sitting in now, as a canvas for a designer, is abundant. It's rich as hell. And there's almost nothing here that I didn't personally design, and a lot that I personally constructed. Yes. So that is a fantastic verdant field on which to put your foot once you walk out the door of a place you've grown. So probably in all truth say I had to get out of Pentagram in order to give myself time to do these things too.
Yes.
Because doing them I just run out of time. So there's that part of it, and I think coincident with that is then very talented young people who I had, in a sense, grown and cultivated on their own, who provide me with a wonderful set of talents for me to employ with none of the day-to-day responsibilities for timesheets and all that game. So I've got the same talent network all around me to use, and I can put my particular single fingers on energy into firms where I'm again back to working with the firm's owner, the firm, etc. So it's all of this has just come about, and it's a set of accidents. It's quite a lot of it to do with the place we're sitting in here, Mike. I think.
Well, I think for the listeners, just describe what we're sitting. I mean, we're sitting in what was a derelict series of farm buildings originally, which you've turned into the most stunning space, I have to say, having never been here before. And I can see just, you know, just fleetingly as I came through the building, that everything has got your hand. And if it's not your hand, then it's the hand of a respected designer. And it's a project. And I can see that, you know, having said, what have you been up to? This is a major project, and it's a beautiful setting, and it's highly visual and a beautiful place to be. So, and it's obviously taking you a long time to do, and it's lovingly done. But along with that, you have been doing obviously various pieces of work. I mean, there's the B&W speakers, which I think are a relatively recent piece of work that you've you've had produced.
I've worked for B&W. I've worked for 30, 40 years. That started with one man. I could call any Sunday and he'd be at the works. any Sunday in the whole year, and he'd be there. And that's a degree of the sort of personal involvement. So gradually that firm grew, and I grew with it and did a lot of work, and the speaker behind you is one of mine.
Yes.
And there's a couple in the in the big room there we'll look at in a moment. So that grew nicely. And then I handed over effectively to a younger designer in 10 years ago or so, and he's done extraordinarily well, but they've kept employing me from time to time on specific things. And there's one out there that was launched this year that is I think one of the nicest I've ever done. So there's a case of history sort of coming back to you.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, I was at a dinner, and I was at the table, was a young man I'd never met before, who we got to talk, and his name's Terry. I'm quite a fatalist, I now begin to think, because when I was at art school, leaping about in history, when I was at art school, I had a job in a spring factory. I got the job because my mother worked there as a spring maker. And that's another range of tales, but I got this job in a spring factory. And this was a tiny, crummy little firm, real squalid outfit, but lovely people. And I worked there in the evening and at the weekends. And in the sort of, in the peerage of spring making, there was a family called Terry, who had a huge spring-making company in the Midlands, who our little firm knew about. You know, you knew that if a spring we couldn't make, Terry would make it, providing they were prepared to, because they only ever made things in hundreds of thousands. So there's this great, you know, sort of empire in the sky called Terry's.
Yeah.
I'm at dinner 5 years ago, Mike, and I'm sitting at this table, there's a nice young chap there, name turns out to be Terry. Turns out to be grandson, great-great-grandson of the Terry Empire. And Terry's, I then was able to tell him, and he probably didn't know, used to make drawing board clips that we all used to hold our paper on the drawing board. Yeah. They were called Terry clips.
Yes.
And if you put your tools into a tool rack, they were held there by Terry clips.
Yeah.
And Terry's used to make chest expanders. So this amazing spring empire.
Yeah.
And the one thing that Terry's in the last decade have continued to make have been anglepoise lamps. Because the anglepoise lamp only exists because of springs.
Yes, the springs on.
So
the,
there's on a the marvelous because of piece of history.
That was reintroduced.
Isn't that interesting?
You brought that back
and
into life.
Well, it was a happy accident because my reputation was still sufficiently high that we designed a new one for them, and it was launched in Milan 5 years ago and it got terrific publicity. Mm. The combination of this quite interesting historical origins of the firm, and a brilliant invention that wasn't mine, the original invention 1926, still is the heart of the product.
Yes.
And so there's their bit of very colourful history and my own coming to it. And we got wonderful, and the thing's taken off from then.
I've recently interviewed Margaret Howell, of course, at her shop in Wigmore Street.
Yeah.
She has the, she sells the,
yes,
the very lamps
that we've
reintroduced.
Yeah, no, and I, she, so I know her, yes, of course.
Well, I'm going to round off now. The question I always pose to any designer in these interviews at the end is the fact that it's highly likely that very young would-be hopeful young designers and maybe product designers will be listening to this wherever they might be in the world. And you're looking back on your long career, which is still very much evident, what sort of little nuggets you might have that you would pass on to any young designer now thinking about embarking in this 21st century of design?
Well, I think there's two parts of it, really. I think two, and they seem to be quite at sort of extremes of the talent you need. One is, I think you've got to be proud if someone called you an artist. That's quite an obligation to live up to, I think, you know, when you see the great artistic talents that make up our society. I think if someone's generous enough to call you an artist, that's quite an accolade. I think to apply that benefit, you've got to know how everything is made. One of my favourite tricks is if I go into a room with 20 or something young designers, I ask them to tell me how everything in the room is made. I don't want them to know, I don't need to know the minutiae of the electronics, but in constructional terms, I need them to say how the bricks came to be there, how the floor came to be there, how the light fitting came to be there. I need them to know, and in knowing, I need to find out whether they're passionate about how it's made, because you, on your way through here, you have got to have had more than respect. You've got to have affection and admiration for those who actually make things.
Yeah.
And I'll finish off with a tale, which I think illustrates it very well. 10-15 years ago now, a wonderful man who you know called Henrian, yes, died. And his wife had a party for him at the vaults of the RSA. And April, who comes from Australia, therefore has Australian inheritance with humour, was with me, and she said, we'd better start planning for yours. So I said, all right. And it caused me to think who we would invite, who I would like to see on the invitation list to my wake. Because in that party, and you were probably there that night, Mike, in that party, they were almost all designers, because in the graphic field, and I know this story to be true because I know of the makeup of Pentagram and sure. its designers and sure. its designers relative to their clients, and almost all the people there that night were designers. In my invitation list, almost all of them would be clients. By clients, I don't mean the marketing guy, I mean the people in the factory, yeah. I mean the toolmakers, I mean the engineers,
yeah.
Because they're the people who actually made my life for me.
Yes.
Without yes. their goodwill,
yes.
without their tolerance and their generosity, I couldn't be sitting here today.
No.
So, you know, to be admired if you're an artist is wonderful,
yeah.
but you'll never get anywhere near being entrusted unless you have the goodwill of that community.
Absolutely. Well, as you've touched on the subject of wakes, just end on a bit of a frivolous note, really, but I noticed coming in to the house downstairs, you have this product that you produced, and I think it's probably tongue-in-cheek, but you'll tell me whether that's true or not. But there was you were on a TV programme not so long ago, you were talking about projects that had failed and how you tried to recycle, for example, some Kenwood toasters by redressing them as buildings with King Kong on the top and so forth, and a baby carrier. But the thing that struck me is that you had come up with a bookcase which doubled as a coffin. And I noticed you've got one downstairs, and I'm wondering whether that is waiting for you.
Yes, it is. It is. It's my size. It's exactly what it is, and it's behind that's a tale. Do you mind?
If no, I do.
My mother died about I don't know, maybe it was 7 or 8 years ago now, and in not bad circumstances. I mean, she'd 97, so she'd had a good long life, and she was ready to go anyway. But that wasn't ever in discussion. But so I think we're comfortable about the fact that time had come, and so we were in a degree prepared for it. But the actual moment was that we're in this nursing home, which is a pleasant enough place with decent enough people, and she actually stopped breathing, and that was the end of it. So in the next hour, I'm sitting in the little office, 10:30 at night, of the matron who runs the place, and I said, because I just said to you, we were in a degree temperamentally prepared, but physically we were unprepared completely. And I said to her, what do we do now? And she said, well, you need an undertaker and this, that and the other. I said, well, how do we find an undertaker? She said, well, I don't know. Because I think she meant that she couldn't. She had a professional responsibility not to say this firm or that firm. So I'm sitting looking at the yellow pages in this woman's office to find an undertaker. In itself, that's bizarre, but true.
Very bizarre.
And we found an undertaker off to go see these people, and it's all the sort of things that make musical jokes about undertakers. They sort of painted the windows black, they only ever used dark red, and it's gloomy as hell, you see. All very quiet, not a smile in sight. I was sitting talking to this fella, and talking about the mechanics and the payment and this, that and the other, you see. And he said, well, what sort of coffin would you like? And I hadn't thought about it. So he got out a book, which was like, and it is actually, a photo album, sort of thing you put your holiday snaps in, padded cover, sort of awful sort of, you know, impressed gold decoration around it. I mean, hideous, actually, in our designer's terms. Open the pages and page after page of coffins with the price against them, you see. And I had to choose one. And that in itself is interesting because you think, well, she would actually hate to waste money at this moment. If there's any money left over, should go to the kids.
Yeah.
So don't waste money on that sort of thing. On the other hand, I, as the son, responsible for the funeral and what the relatives are going to think, you see.
Yeah.
So I think, well, I can't really put her in a cardboard box, you know. So I'm choosing something down the middle. And after that I thought, you know, this is terrible. I mean, I would hate to leave that sort of silly situation after all these years of thinking about how to do something, always thinking about, you know, if I buy a new toilet roll, I have a thought about what sort of toilet roll it is. It's midlife, I can't help it. So to that ultimate moment, leave it in the hands of this silly, bloody moment. So so I thought I'd better design one. That's how it came about.
Well, Kenneth Grange, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.